So last time we started looking at circuits that contain different elements, and the circuits could be arbitrarily complex. And there are physics principles that you can use in analyzing such circuits that will allow you to get independent equations that you can then use to solve for things that you don't know in the circuit. And you know, they can be arbitrarily nasty. Of course, if they are, you have more and more equations and more things. So there's certainly a limit to how nasty you'll see them be. Just be aware in the real world that as they get nasty, you know, basically you use computers to help sort of iteratively solve these kinds of things. But the basic things that constrain the problem are all the same. So in general, in order to solve for such a thing, basically you'll be given a circuit and you can have some number of things that are unknown. It might be the currents, it might be a resistance, it might be the EMFs or some combination of those things. And so if the currents are not already assigned to you, you know, they aren't labeled and the direction isn't already given, then you have to analyze the circuit and put the currents in. And you'll have no idea what direction the current's going, because that really depends on the details of the circuit and how it's all hanging together. That's why you have to do all these equations at the same time. So you just have to pick and choose, and if you choose the wrong direction, then in the end, if you follow all the conventions and you get to the end, you get a negative value for that current, and it means that that current still exists, it's just going the way it's opposite to the direction you chose. So you look at the arbitrarily nasty circuit, you select independent loops, so that means you look at the circuit and you choose all the pathways that you could, if you were a little ant, walk along and have new elements in the circuit every time you go out for a parabola around the circuit. And this would be an independent loop. This would be an independent loop. This would be an independent loop, because for each of those loops, I have passed some elements of this circuit that I didn't see in my other walks, okay? And then once you have those, all of them are constrained by the fact that if I walk around a closed loop, I have to come back to the same potential. I can have potential changes all along the way, but if I go from point A back to point A, the change in the potential has to be zero. So you sum up the potential increases and drops around the loop, and it has to be zero. So you do that for each of the independent loops. Similarly, you have these currents, however you choose them. Again, they should be independent currents. They should be the currents that you're sort of stuck with. So for example, if I have a current in this piece of the loop, when it encounters this place, it has to split into two different currents. You don't know what they are because they depend on these resistances and they depend on the potential that goes across, none of which is established yet. So all you know is that if I have an I1 here, I'll have an I2 here and an I3 here. And then when they come back together, the I2 and the I3 have to recombine into the I1 because you have that conservation of the current. Okay? When you get to this point, now you've got a new thing here. The current here is not necessarily the current here, so this would be another current. So you have to think your way through the entire circuit in that way and sum up currents. And then you have to choose the currents that meet at every junction where you have independent currents. You'll sometimes run into junctions where you've already dealt with all the currents that are meeting at that junction, in which case you don't get independent information making an equation about that. But the sum of the currents at any given junction is equal to zero. All that says is whatever's coming in is the same that leaves. You're not creating current at any of these junctions or destroying them. So once you, if you're careful with the independent things and you're careful with the conventions we'll talk about in a moment, then you'll end up with some number of equations. And you can have up to that number of unknowns and solve analytically for these types of problems. And, you know, the algebra could be ridiculous. You really don't fear me having... You don't need to fear me making it that ridiculous for two reasons. One, because maybe three reasons. I'm a nice guy. I don't want to make your life too miserable. Two reasons. And three, the TAs would absolutely kill me if I made it really complicated, because it becomes impossible to grade. All of you would choose, you know, labeling things in different ways. So having
done it once on an exam many years ago, having come close to losing my life to the TAs, I'm very aware of this. Okay, so let's think about this for a moment. Here is a circuit. I have labeled EMFs and resistances. And if I were giving you this problem, I might actually give you numbers, or I might not. If I'm labeling them, I might tell you they're known, which means you just think of them as a symbol that you know, and you would solve for other things in terms of those symbols. But you don't really need to know what these things are right now, or even what I'm asking for or giving yet, if I were to ask you to look at this and tell me how many independent currents you would have in that circuit. I want you to actually go through the exercise deciding that for yourself. Okay? If you think there are zero currents, raise your hand. One, two, three. This counts as 2.5. I saw some hands go up. Four. A few more. Five. Six. Seven. Eight. Okay. Let's ponder it. If I have a current here, it has to go all the way around here. So this piece clearly shares one current. Okay? If that current encounters this junction, it'll split into two. Some of it will go this way, some of it will go down that branch. Those are now different currents. So here's one. Now I'll get a second one. Let's just call it, I could call it third. I mean, it doesn't matter, but I'll call it the second one. And we'll just say it's going like this. It could be going the opposite direction. It doesn't matter. I'll just choose, right? So I might have one, then two. But this is a third one that comes down here in this branch. But when it encounters this branch, I now have these two pieces. I haven't seen those before. So this current number three will split into a current four and a current five. So I have one, two, three, four, five. Comes back together, I'm back to five. When I get to here, all of these are coming back together, so I have nothing new. So I have one, two, three, four, five different currents. Okay? How many independent loops do you see if you wanted to be an ant walking around the loop, while walking around the circuit, going from a point A to a point A, whatever it is? How many independent topological loops could you walk around in order to sum up the voltages to zero? Zero. One. Two. Three. Four. Five. Six. Seven. Eight. Okay. If I start here, I mean, there are different ways to do it, so that may be an issue. Let's think our way through it. If I were just going to do this problem, I might walk like this.
Okay, that might be one. I then might walk like this. That might be two. It's independent because this piece wasn't in the last loop. Okay? And then I might walk like this. And this is independent because then I have these two things that are new. Okay? But now if you look at it, there is no piece of this circuit that I haven't walked around. Yes, I could do this. But I encounter pieces that have already been walked. I've already done that, this, and that. Okay? So this would not be an independent loop if I use those other three. You could choose a different set. I could choose to do this one. I could choose to do this one. And then I could choose to do that one. Those all three have independent pieces. Okay? But I can't find a fourth where I haven't already used the other three. Where I haven't already used everything. If I have already chosen three. Okay? There is no stone tablet that tells you you need to go clockwise or counterclockwise, nor does it tell you that you need to do just little loops and not the big loop or whatever. I find if you sort of look at this thing and you choose the topological holes in the donut, it sort of helps keep you straight. Here's a hole, here's a hole, here's a hole. For this. Yeah.
Can you do it in two by walking around and resistor three in one path and then coming down and including resistor four in the other? And like dividing that centrally?
Yeah. You could do this with resistor three, this with resistor four. That'd be fine. But and if you do that, now you've actually covered everything. So now that I stop and think about it, if you then add this one, you're not independent. So in fact, it's two. It's not even three. Thank you. So someday, when you have a lot of experience like me, you will find that it's as easy for you as it is for me. Okay? It's subtle in places. And one of the things you'll find, and you know, I'll try not to do this to you on the test, unless you give me good reason to. Sometimes how it's drawn can make it more or less confusing in terms of picking out the topological pieces and getting the loops right. At any rate, that's the idea, is to do the minimal number of loops that cover all of the elements, where you basically follow the lines with a pencil, but you don't let it up. Okay? All right. So, in fact, there are two loops here, not three, because I think you can go, like she said, you can manage to do it in two. Okay, so that last question I have, how many independent current junctions would you have that would give you a current equation, a current conservation equation? Zero, one, two, three. More than three. There are one, two, three, four junctions where the currents meet. Let's imagine that we choose, we look at them each individually. Here's one. This one involves this current, whatever it is, this current, whatever it is, and the current that goes up and down that branch. Okay? So that's three currents. So that's clearly, it's the first one we chose, so we'll call that independent. This current comes down, it'll split into this current and that current. So there is another independent current equation there. Now, having chosen those two, and I could have started at the bottom instead, okay, so we start at the top this time, so we get one here and one here. If we get down to here, you have this current and that current coming back together into this current, which is the same as that current, so you get exactly the same as you had for the second junction that we chose. So that's not independent. The current that's in this piece is the same as the current in that piece. And at this junction, it's coming back and joining these two currents, but that's the same combination of things you have at the top. So there are two independent current equations in this equation, in this thing. So we have two independent voltage loops and two independent current equations. And we said 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We said 5 independent currents, which is true because you can get independent currents there. So I could give you a problem with 4 of any of these things missing and ask you to solve them. Okay, any questions on this? Okay, so actually, before I finish with this, we talked about the independent loops, but in order to get the equations right for the voltage zones, for the current equations, you can either think, given your choice of currents, whatever they are, and directions, incoming currents equal the outgoing currents, or you could just set the sum of currents equal to zero, where incoming you might call positive and outgoing you might call negative, or you can flip that sum. It doesn't matter as long as you're consistent. For the voltage loops, the way to think about it is you parabola around your loops. And in fact, when I wrote this, I was thinking 3 loops, which we don't have. So we can choose 2 independent junctions. I think on the last page we said this one and that one, but it could have been this one and that one. It doesn't matter because these two have the same sets of currents. So you get 2 equations there. And then basically think of just sort of walking around the circuit in some direction. It doesn't matter whether it's clockwise or counterclockwise, so I did these in opposite directions. And then you keep count of the voltage increases and drops as you go around. And in order to do that, there's a convention that you have to use. The pink lines here represent the direction that you are walking across the element. If you are walking across a resistor in the direction of the current, by convention, that comes into the voltage sum, the minus IR. If you are walking across a resistor in a direction opposite of the current, that comes in with a plus IR. If you're walking in the direction of the EMF as you go around, so in this case, for example, I'm going around like this and I would walk against the EMF instead of with the EMF. Here, if you walk with the EMF, it's a plus EMF for the voltage sum, and if you walk against it, it's a minus EMF. Here, I'd be walking with it, so I would take a plus E2. Here, I'm walking against it, minus E2. And so all of those sums are to zero if you go all the way around. Okay? So I don't know what else to say with this. You really just sort of have to do some problems and get the hang of it. In the end, it's really not bad. It's just a little tedious. And the algebra can be a pain. I probably gave you a couple of homework problems where the algebra verges on being a little bit of a pain. They're probably at least 1 3-week problem. You need to have done one of them once just to make sure you're believing. But otherwise, hopefully most of them won't be too bad. Okay? Yes?
So I understand how there are 2 loopies, but I also understand how there can be 3. It seems like with 3 there aren't redundant ones as long as you make a big one and then a half one and another half one. And I'm confused why you can have both of them.
A big one
and a half one and a half one?
Like, if you make a big one and then you do half of it and then you do the little one in the middle the way that you said it?
Okay, so you do a big one here.
Yeah.
And you do a little one here. That you can do, but that's still two.
Okay, never mind. Thank you.
Yeah, because the big one covers everybody else, and this one gets what you left out. So you can do it, I mean, you can do it different ways, and it should work, so.
Wait.
So it's a little bit scary, because you have to commit. You have to decide and then jump on. But I want you to take your time, because if you screw up and choose the wrong loops, you can spend all day on the conventions and the algebra and do all of that perfectly and be very screwed up and wrong when you get to the end because you've thrown in something that isn't started. Okay, so set up everything very carefully at the beginning.
Don't you have to have the middle bar included, though?
The what bar?
The middle one. Yeah, and if you just do the little one in the middle and the big one, then you don't have that. Does that matter?
If I do just this one, I don't think that matters. You're asking me, do I have to have this piece of the circuit? No. I just need to make sure everything is connected. Let's see, is that true? I think it works because you can't avoid the middle here when you do the current equations.
Okay.
So in the full set of equations, you will have something that represents the current that's going through that piece.
Okay.
And that's what ties to it. Because if you do this loop and you do that loop, you're right in the sense that the loops don't hit this section, but they are tied together in the sense that whatever current you have in this branch is related to these currents and related to those currents, and that comes into the current equation. Okay, so we are doing the thinking about this circuit as if it is a static circuit, basically. The currents are moving, but you've thrown down some EMFs, and you've thrown down some resistors, and you've assumed the batteries don't become dead. And so it's basically a steady state thing once you've got it in place. So life becomes a little more fun if you add in capacitors to the system. So what I wanted to talk about now would be something that goes under the category of RC circuits, where R stands for resistance and C for capacitance. So let's imagine that I have an EMF. And I have a capacitor. And I have a resistor. And I make a circuit like this. So what this is a switch.
So you can imagine that switch is a conductor that I can flip up and have the circuit look like this, or I can flip it down and have it look like this. Yes?
Just one thing, if we're going back to the previous question, you said we had five unknowns, so that's five unknown currents, and we had two junctions and two loops, and we don't have the variables, but we don't have equations for every unknown, so how does that work?
So you're saying we have the two junction equations, we have the two loops, and I have five currents here.
I
think that means with this topology, if I were to give it to you, I would have to specify one term. I can only give you four and enough to have it analytically solvable. I mean, I think you can have done such that I can connect things together and have it not easily analytical solvable. Maybe I'm missing something, but I think that's the case. That's partly why I try to do the problems before I give you the exam. I have only on one occasion that I know of actually given a problem that was impossible to do. And I did do it before I gave the exam. It's just I made a mistake when I was working out the solution, so I thought it was doable when it turned out not to be. That was a bad day. So I discovered it about 3/4 of the way through the exam. Not good. Okay, so let us imagine that we flip the switch up to this point. That effectively takes this branch away, okay? Not effectively, I mean no current flows because it has nowhere to go. So that just isn't part of the equation, not part of the system anymore. So if we have this thing flipped up, now we have this circuit. And what's going to happen is if I connect it, I throw the switch up, the capacitor is going to get charged because we have it across the EMF, so there's a voltage that's going to go through that. So I would call this a charging RC circuit. Because when I connect the capacitor, clearly it's going to charge it. And the thinking that we have just been doing is really the same as what we want to do now, in the sense that at any given moment in time, I can go walking around the circuit, even while the capacitor is being charged, and I can sum the voltages as I go around. You might imagine that first the capacitor has no charge across it, so there should not be a potential difference across the capacitor plates. As I build up charge, that potential difference across the plates should grow. As it grows, the current's going to change, which means the voltage dropped across this resistor is going to change. So what happens when we throw in these capacitors, we end up sort of incorporating a time dependence into this whole thing. So what we want to do is to look at the voltage equation as we walk around the circuit, but not really fret about it in terms of time. Let's just do it as we walk around. So we start, say, here, and we walk across the EMF. So let's imagine that I'm now walking around like this. So 0 is equal to a positive EMF because I'm going across the EMF in the direction of the EMF. I now go across the resistor. Let's assume that I'm going in the direction of the current because the current is, remember, positive, so it's going to flow this way. So that means if I'm going in the direction of the current through the resistor, I have a minus IR. And then I go across the capacitor. And remember that Q is equal to CV. So V is equal to Q over C at any given time. So if at a given moment I have a charge Q on that capacitor, then we argue that you have a capacitive, a voltage drop as you go across the capacitor, which is equal to this Q over C.
So this would be, say, the voltage drop across the resistor. This would be the voltage drop across the capacitor. EMF is a constant. The current is dQ over dt. This is the resistance minus Q over C. So we now have brought in a time dependence because we now have something where we have a rate of the flow. It depends on the rate of the flow of the charge, and we have the charge in there. So if you're into these sorts of things, this would be, I guess, what we would call a first order, because the derivative is a first derivative instead of a second derivative or third derivative or fourth derivative. A first order ordinary, in that you only depend on single variables instead of multiple variables, where you'd be stuck having these partial derivatives here. Differential, because we have derivatives in here. Equation. So it's a first order ordinary differential equation. How many of you have had differential equations? How many of you want to take differential equations? So a handful of you have seen this. I'm not going to drag you through this, but it's just a mathematical equation, and you can actually solve it. Okay? It has analytical exact solution. And I am going to give you the solution for this problem, and then we're going to spend time thinking about the solution itself. So Q here is a function of time, and if we were to solve this first order ordinary differential equation. Are any of you math majors? No. I'll tell you, when you're a math major, there's one thing that sort of annoys the crap out of you. And that is, the higher the level of the course, the thinner is the textbook, and the textbook names become things like Introduction to Elementary Algebra, or linear algebra. Solving ordinary differential equations. It's like, okay. At least make it complex differential equations or something. I've been working my butt off for 3 years, and it's Introduction to Ordinary whatever. And the book gets really thin, so it's like this reversion back to kindergarten after a while. It sort of feels like, okay, that felt good. I have been wanting to vent about that for years. Sorry. Okay, so here's the charge. And what we do is I'm going to write down the solution. The charge as a function of time is equal to C times the EMF times 1 minus E. To the minus T over RC. And those of you who've had differential equations can tell everybody else that that's true. But we can all convince ourselves that that's true. And the way that you can convince yourself that it's true is you take this and you plug it in for Q. And you take the derivative of this and you put it here. And you take this and you put it here. And you'll see that the equation works. Okay? So that's how you can prove it to yourself. But this is the solution to that equation that we get. So let's look at what it looks like. So what I want to do is to ponder the little pieces here first for a second. So what we have is the Q of T is equal to C times epsilon times 1 minus E to the minus T over RC. So let me remind you what some of these pieces look like. You have seen them many times before, but if you're like me, you don't remember this crap in a math class because you sort of have to see it in some reason that you actually need to know it for it to stick. So let's imagine, let's look at what e to the x is. If this is x, e to the x starts at 1 and goes up exponentially as a function of x. E to the minus x looks like that, starting at 1 and dropping exponentially, but it's asymptotic to 0 as it goes out. We don't have e to the minus x, we have e to the minus t over rc, and we're doing this as a function of time, not as a function of x. So if this is a function of time, then starting with 1 here, I can have a function that will look like this, which is e to the minus t over rc. What it really means, this minus t over rc says that when I get to a time, rc, when t is equal to rc, e, this thing, is equal to e to the minus 1. So that means you drop to a value which is 1 over e of the original thing, which I didn't quite draw the scale. I think 1 over e is something like 0.3 something. It's right in there. It's like a third-ish. Okay? So to read the e to the t minus rc, what it means is as a function of time, when time reaches rc, the value is dropped from 1 down to 1 over e. What I want you to observe here momentarily is that if you think of this as time, and this is a quantity that's following with time, I can tune it by choosing RC. If RC is big, this thing drops much more slowly. If RC is small, it drops very quickly. Okay, the mathematical function. So that's what this piece looks like. Now, 1 minus that if here is 1, we start out at 0 because 1 minus 1 is 0. And then as we go out as a function of time, this curve goes back down to 0. So we are subtracting less and less from 1. So the curve looks something like this. And if you do it this way, when you get to t equal to rc, then it will have risen to 1 minus e to the minus 1. 1 minus 1 over e. And now we take all of that and we multiply it by c epsilon. So that means we simply normalize things. So t is increasing as we go out. We have an asymptotic value, which is c epsilon. And this equation is c epsilon 1 minus e to the minus t over rc, which is what we have as the solution of that equation. So let's see if it makes any sense. Let me remind you momentarily what we're doing in the first place before we started talking about all these silly equations. Let's see if it makes any sense. We start out having thrown the switch. And when we throw the switch, we have no charge whatsoever on the capacitor. So that means this current's going to flow very much. It's going to flow at a maximal value because there is no charge over here effectively trying to push it back. Okay? So the current's going to flow quite a bit. What I have plotted here, remember we were solving for the charge as a function of time. We start out with zero charge on the capacitor because we had nothing across it. So we start out at zero, but the slope of Q as a function of time is maximal and positive. As time passes, I build up charge over here. As I build up charge over here, you can imagine that it's now going to be harder to push the current across the resistor because there's now charge over here. So the rate at which the charge flows should decrease, which means the slope, dq over dt, remember, is the derivative of this, is going to drop. As it drops, it eventually drops to zero, okay, as a function of time. What happens out here is you keep charging and keep charging and keep charging until you reach the limiting value for the charge on that capacitor. That is, the voltage across the capacitor is equal to the EMF. Q is equal to CV, so that will be the instance when the charge is equal to C times epsilon, which is when you get the voltage across here is equal to the voltage across here. Okay, so what you have is this curve rising exponentially and asymptotically approaching the ultimate limit, which is the C epsilon. Any questions? It's pretty good, isn't it? We've taken now this really boring stuff that's very static, and added in a time. Okay. Now what I'd like to do is to go back to our original circuit. Let's say that we flip this switch up and we wait a long time. When you read problems that involve these kinds of things, there will be particular words in English that tell you something very important about it, such as, the switch is thrown and you wait a long time. What does that mean? What that means is you are waiting until you have reached that asymptotic limit so that you know what the charge is across that capacitor. If they tell you the switch is thrown and you wait just a little short time, then you know the charge may not have built up on this capacitor, and you would actually have to use that equation to calculate how much charge is there at that time. But if they say wait a long time, then you can assume that the capacitor is fully charged. So we throw the switch, we wait a long time, the capacitor is fully charged. We now throw the switch back down to here. Okay, and now we have a fully charged capacitor hooked directly across the resistor. So now what's going to happen is the charge that's on that capacitor is going to flow through the resistor until the charge on the capacitor is zero. So the circuit we have is now, this, so we're going to say we have a fully charged capacitor at t equals zero, q is equal to this C epsilon value, if you wish, q zero is, okay? And we will call this circuit a discharging RC circuit. now we play the same game. If we have current flowing across the resistor, then you can imagine that we will call that a minus IR, a voltage drop across the resistor. There's only two elements here. The sum of the voltages have to be zero, so we're going to consider the voltage across the capacitor to be positive so that they can cancel. Well, don't want to do it that way. We'll go ahead and let it be negative for a moment. That's what we had. The EMF is now zero. So we have that dQ over dt is equal to minus Q over RC. So all I've done is I've taken this, moved it to that side, changed I to dQ over dt, and pulled the R back over. So we got that. Now I'm going to take the dt and put it here, and Q and put it there. So we get dQ over Q, not D, is equal to minus 1 over RC dt. I'll integrate both sides while the charge goes from Q0 to some Q as a function of time. And I'll integrate the other side. This will happen from a time 0 to t. If you look up the integral on the left-hand side, integral of dq over q is natural log. So this is going to be the natural log of q at time t over q0. And that's going to be equal to minus t over rc, because the minus 1 over rc pulls out, and the integral of dt is just t. I can get rid of the natural log by taking the exponential of both sides. So I get q over q0 is equal to e to the minus t over rc, where q at time t is equal to the initial charge that I have, which maybe I called big Q, so now I'm going to go instead. It's e to the minus t over rc. So what does that look like? That is an exponential that is falling from a value of Q0. So if I were to look at the charge on the capacitor as a function of time, it'd be starting out at a value, which is the initial Q0, which I may have called big Q a moment ago. Don't know. And it will drop exponentially like this. This is e to the minus t over rc. And if I go to a distance, if I go a time rc, then I drop by an amount 1 over e times q0.
So you have sort of a similar behavior to what we had a moment ago, but so charging the capacitor is discharging. Again, the behavior is exponential, and it is characterized in terms of time by this exponential to the minus t over rc. So rc is a quantity that determines the degree of the exponential falls off with respect to time, how fast it falls off. If this RC is very big, then for this to drop and reach this point, it takes a long time because that time has to be equal to RC. If that RC is a small number, then this falls off really fast. Okay? To sort of point that out here earlier too. So if I have a large RC here, it takes a long time to charge it up. But it should actually look exponential anyway. If I have a short time, if I have a small RC, then it takes a very short time to charge it up. The exponential, you can only take an exponential like this of a unitless number. So it turns out that the units of r times c, if you work it out, is time. So this is actually a time, and we call rc the time constant for the circuit. And you'll note that the behavior of the circuit is fixed. If I have a fixed R and a fixed C, that time dependence is fixed. Okay, that exponential is going to be faster, slow, whatever it is, but it's stuck being what it is unless you were able to change the R and the C. Okay? Any questions? All right. So, what I'm showing you here, let me see if I can unclip something here. Yeah, okay. So what I have that I'm showing in time dependence is I have a box over here which puts a positive voltage on, which is a battery that basically has a positive voltage that then flips to become a negative voltage, and then there's a positive voltage. And if I take that and I make a graph of it as a function of time, you can imagine here is the voltage that's across this battery if I use it to put it across a circuit. It's negative, and then it becomes positive, basically the same value, okay? So it's like I have a battery in a circuit that I have be one way for a moment, and then I flip it the other way, okay? And I plot that out as a function of time, this being the zero of the voltage. You good with that? Now I'm going to take that battery, and I'm going to put it across a capacitor and a resistor. So what we have is basically the initial state that we just started with, which is I have a capacitor and resistor that I put a battery across, okay? So it should be charging the capacitor up, and then after a moment, I take this stupid battery and I flip it around. So now the capacitor is going to discharge and or charge up the other way if you want to think about it. So let's see if it makes any sense. So the curve that just appeared is, equivalently, it is the voltage across the capacitor. Q is equal to CV, so that voltage is Q over C. So what you see here is a curve that is proportional to
the charging curve that we saw, right? Which was the charge as a function of time across the capacitor. So don't worry about this for a moment. Let us imagine that this is zero voltage for a moment. Now, I put it across the capacitor, and what you see is that the charge in the capacitor is growing and growing and growing exponentially. Okay? And then I drop the voltage down to zero, if you will, so it's like discharging it, and you see that it discharges exponentially. So that would be the second solution that we just saw. Okay? If I increase R, or C, or both, what you're going to see is it's going to take longer to get up here. If I decrease them, it's going to happen very fast. So let me do that. Okay, so here is a resistor that's variable, and I am going to decrease the resistance. If I decrease the resistance, what's going to happen to that curve? RC becomes less, which means it's going to charge and discharge faster. Okay? So that curve, if I make it bigger, it's going to be slower, even to the point that it doesn't fully charge. If I do the same thing with the capacitor, if I reduce the capacitance, it's much faster. Okay? If I increase the capacitor, I can again make it go slow. Alright? So that's the behavior of an RC circuit. So I hope you're beginning to see, as you begin to put these different elements into the circuits, you can begin to get some interesting time dependence in these things. And that's, of course, where the utility of electronics comes in. Is usually it's a very dynamic system. So don't be fooled by doing too many Kirchhoff's laws problems and think it's all a static thing. It's not. Any questions on the RC stuff? Start something new. What we've talked about so far is a force of nature that you are most aware of in weather like we have today every time you take on or off your shirt or try to pet a cat or a dog or rub, whatever, right? Because you have static electricity all over the place. So you're sort of used to it. And it clearly is a force, right? If you take your cat and you rub it on the side of your head and you try to pull it apart, your hair goes out. Right? So there's no question that there is a force there, and that's really been what we've looked at. We've called it the force of electrostatics because we have really worried about steady-state systems, although we did look at what happens if you now have a conductor and you put a potential difference across it and you have charge flows in the conductor. For most of the time, we looked at a static situation where the current was at least steady, so the rate of change current flow was steady. And then we added in a little bit of time dependence at the end, so that current is even changing a little bit. So things are getting a little bit more dynamic. But there's been some stuff that we have completely omitted, which turns out that you would run into in the real world if you went and looked for it. But the simplest manifestation of it actually in our world seems to exist as a different force altogether. Instead of rubbing socks together and stuff and feeling this electrostatic force, it manifests itself as like little magnets, okay? And you've all played with magnets. I hope if you haven't, you should go buy a couple and play with them because they're sort of fun. But compass needles are examples of little magnets. And a compass needle, we all know, lines up along the magnetic field of the Earth, whatever that is, and points basically to a magnetic north, which, by the way, isn't exactly the geographic North Pole, but it's close. If you take two compass needles and you put them together, you'll notice they affect each other. Okay, so if you have two magnets and you start playing with them, you'll note that if you have what we call the North Pole and the South Pole, the two magnets approach each other, they'll want to stick together. And if you take the North Pole and the North Pole, they'll want to sort of repel each other. Okay, so this is stuff that I hope you've all had a chance to just play with. So in the real world, that's what you see. And there are certain stones that are out there that are naturally magnetized, we call them. So they basically are like little magnets. And so they're not quite what you might go buy in a store. They're not as strong as that. But you can see these effects. So these effects have been known for a very long time. As you saw last time, what we did, we said, well, if we have a force, we describe the electrostatic force as being due to an electric field. And it turns out that's a pretty fruitful thing to do. And in the Newtonian picture of the universe, that's sort of how we picture how a force is conveyed. So we say if we have a mass, it creates a gravitational field in the space around it, so that if I put another mass, it feels gravitational attraction. If I have a charge, it creates an electric field in the space around it. I put another charge, there's a force on it. If I have a magnet, it creates what we will call a magnetic field in space around it, such that if I have another magnet, it will feel a force. So it's really not any different. So there exists, for the moment, let us just say there exists a force of nature that we will call magnetism. And we will say that it is there because whatever it is creating a magnetic field in space. And if there is a magnetic field in space, then things can happen. If you feel magnetic fields, there will be a force on it. Okay? So that may sound a little bit not super motivated. I think it'll begin to make sense before too long, so I want you to just hang with me for a minute. There is a way to motivate it that's much cleaner, which actually involves special relativity. And in fact, the primary reason that Einstein invented relativity initially was because he was trying to understand electricity and magnetism and how they're related. But I think it's not worth our while to approach it that way. I may do some relativity with you guys later in the semester. But for right now, I'll put it off because we need to jump into magnetism, whatever it is. So let's just say that that's where we are, and let's begin looking at it. So we quantify the force of magnetism primarily through what we call the Lorentz force law. The Lorentz force law has two pieces. One piece you're very familiar with, which is if I have an electric field in space and I have an electric charge, then there's a force that is in the direction of the electric field, which is equal to QE. There's another term to this. And it turns out that if I have a magnetic field in space, there will be a force on a charge if it is moving with a velocity V. And the direction of this force, the magnitude will be QVB, and the direction will be QV cross V. And this is known as the Lorentz force law. So this is basically the full law that we use to determine the force on charges that are out in the world. This is known as the Lorentz force law for this guy, Heinrich Lorentz. So you can imagine I have some region in space, there is an electric field, there's a magnetic field, there's some charge of some sign that's moving with some velocity v. That's the force that you would find on it. Okay? So this has within it some pieces that many of you, I hope, have played with magnets before. But if you look at this equation for a moment, you realize there's some things you may not have done that are going to be pretty dramatic. And we'll do demo. I should have set up one of the demos this time, but we'll do it next class. QV, that's a moving charge. Hello, that's a current, right? So what this says is if I take a current and I put a magnetic field, if I take a big magnet and put it near a current, like a current-carrying wire, there's going to be a force on it. And there is, and it's dramatic. So in the laboratory, when you start messing around, you very quickly find out that there is an intimate relationship somehow between charges and electricity and magnetism. And that's something we don't normally get when we're just playing with little magnets. So there's a lot that's tied up in this. And that's what we're going to spend the next few weeks. But let me make sure we're sort of all on board with some of this. You guys ever heard of this thing, cross product? I see a few heads going up and down. Professor Jordan made you all experts on this, right?
We didn't do it.
Huh?
We didn't do cross product.
You didn't do
them? No.
Do you know how to do them that you haven't actually done them? Alright. I've been there before. I think I know exactly what you're talking about, actually. Okay. Well, the reason I'm asking is I figured you've done them, but you really didn't do them. Where you do them in Physics 113 is often figuring out angular momentum, r cross p. That's sort of the main place. That kind of thing. So if you do a lot with angular momentum and precession, did you do anything with precession?
No.
No. Okay. You're lucky you didn't have me. So you do see it in mechanics, but you don't really have to get it. Those days are now over for you. You now must really get the cross product. So we're going to spend some time with the cross product. So let me remind you for a moment about the dot product. If you recall the dot product, if I have two vectors, say a vector A, and let me say I have some vector B out here, okay? I have the same vector. I just move it over here so that it has its tail at the same point where A's is. And I will say that there is an opening angle between these two when they are configured tail to tail like this. I'll call it A. The dot product, if you recall, A dot B is equal to A, the magnitude of A, times the magnitude of B, times the cosine of the angle between them. Physically, what that does, if we stop and think that, I'm going to actually redraw this because it is not suited to what I want to do with it. So here's my A. Here's my B. And let's say here's the angle between them. Consider B as having a component that is along A and a component that is perpendicular to A. This piece would be B times the sine of theta, and this piece would be B times the cosine of theta. So you can think of the dot product as being a way of multiplying these two vectors such that I'm taking my vector A magnitude and I'm multiplying it by that piece of B that is along A. So we use, for work, for example, we use force dotted into distance, the angle F dot ds, because what we want to do is to project out its work when you exert a force along the direction you're moving. So there's this special part of this thing that is projecting out that piece that's parallel to what you're interested in. Okay? I can think of this as, instead of taking B and putting it in components, I can take A and put it in components. So you can think of this as the vector B multiplied by that piece of A that is along B. You can look at it either way. So that means A dot B is the same thing as B dot A. Okay. And if you want to algebraically do this in components, if I think of A as having three components, AX, AY, Z, and B as having three components, AX, B, X, B, Y, B, Z, then A dot B is equal to AX times BX plus AY times BY plus AZ times BZ. And it is a scalar. That means it is a number, not a vector. Right? So I hope that's all painfully familiar to you all. If it's not, you probably should go make it so. Okay? The cross product is a little different. For the cross product, we could start out with the same picture. A cross B, and note that there's a lot of room for confusion here. I could easily write this as A cross B, and if you have an X in the problem, you can sort of imagine the confusion. So try to be a little careful with that. This is an algebraic symbol. This is a vector algebra symbol, okay? A cross B, the magnitude of it is equal to the magnitude of A times the magnitude of B times the sine of the angle between them. So what this does is it takes A, the magnitude of A, and it multiplies it by that component of B, which is at right angles to it, not along them. Okay? Note that I have magnitude here. I didn't have to do that here. The dot product gives you something that is nothing but a number. I have magnitude lines here and here because I'm taking out the vector character. This is just a number. These are each just the x components, the y components, and z components. Those are numbers of those vectors. Those are the components of the vector. That is not the case with the cross product. The cross product turns out to be a vector. That vector has this magnitude, and it is in a direction. So it is a vector. Let me make sure that's a big deal. It's a vector, and the direction is given by what we will call the right-hand rule. All right. In this case, the direction is into the board. So we're going to come back and do a lot of this, but let me just give you a preview of how this is done. First of all, this is your right hand. You can laugh if you want, but if you start doing this shit in the next exam with your left hand, every answer you have is going to be exactly wrong. I kid you not. Everyone will be exactly the wrong direction. So if you have to write a big R on your hand, you do that. But you use your right hand for this, okay? So to do the right hand rule, you take your hand and imagine that these fingers are in the plane of the paper. You put your fingers along the first vector, which is A. You curl them in the plane of the paper toward the second vector, along the direction where the angle is smallest, so I'm not going around the big way, I'm going the small way, and your thumb points at right angles to both those vectors into the board. Life with magnetism gets a little harder because we just went totally 3D. I have a V this way, I have a V that way, and the stupid thing has a force that's off at right angles to both of them, okay? So it's going to get a little crazy for you. At any rate, today's Tuesday, right? So see you Thursday.